Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast, where we explore the complex landscape of AI regulation with diverse voices from various backgrounds. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have the privilege of speaking with Nicholas Dirks, an internationally recognized historian, anthropologist, and leader in higher education. Nick is currently the president of the New York Academy of Sciences. With a distinguished career spanning across prestigious institutions such as University of California, Berkeley, Columbia University, Nicholas brings a wealth of expertise to our discussion on AI regulation. In his extensive career, he has demonstrated a commitment to interdisciplinary innovation, accessibility in education, and global collaboration, which are critical aspects when considering the regulation of AI. So without further ado, let's welcome Nicholas Dirks to our podcast. Nick, welcome to our podcast.
Great to be here with you, Sanjay.
Wonderful. Nick, you have written quite a bit about AI, and I was really fascinated with some of your work and some of your writings. Can you just give a quick update to our audience? And our audience, Nick, is a global audience, members of Congress, Senate, think tanks, staff of members of Congress, legislators around the world, and industry leaders. Tell them just a little bit about yourself. And then also, you have drawn parallels between the development of AI and the creation of nuclear weapons during World War II. How do you view those parallels?
Sure. Well, let me begin just with a little background. As I hasten to say, I'm not a computer scientist, so I don't code or write algorithms. But I've been a student, like so many others, of new technologies. And I've been a student of these technologies both as an anthropologist and historian, interested in the role of technology in science and the shaping of human history. But also as an educator, really interested in the role that everything from the internet to new kinds of computation, the entry into the digital age, and now, of course, artificial intelligence and the explosion in particular around large language models, for how we think about the fundamentals of education at every level, both as a means to assist educational outcomes, and of course, is something that we need to study, not just in terms of the computer science side of it, which is a large part of what I did when I was at Berkeley, working with a distinguished group of computer scientists who were themselves cutting-edge researchers in artificial intelligence, but also around the kind of social, cultural, political, and economic effects of these technologies and of AI in particular, and the pervasiveness of AI, the power of AI, raises many older questions to a new level, and I think puts in sharp relief some of the kinds of things that we've been thinking about ever since, say, in 1956, John McCarthy and others coined the term artificial intelligence, but have only in the last 10, 15 years began to see as not just changing the world of education, but changing the world itself. So in relation to your question about parallels between the development of this technology and earlier ones that in particular bring to mind the development of nuclear weapons and, of course, the Manhattan Project and the role of Robert Oppenheimer and all of that, which, of course, we've been riveted about over the last year because of Chris Nolan's film. I think the important thing to say is that, you know, we know that technology has changed human life in fundamental ways, whether it was, you know, the discovery of fire, the invention of the wheel, the kinds of things that went into the agricultural revolution and then into the industrial revolution. And of course, we know in particular that over the last 200-300 years, our world has changed dramatically because of the role of science and technology. But we also know there seems to be an ever-increasing pace in relationship to change. Now, I was just, in fact, reading a paper earlier today about Einstein and the extent to which he thought of his initial inventions that, of course, were about relativity in relation not just to theoretical physics, but also to philosophy. And one of the thinkers that he was very familiar with at the time was Henri Bergson, who thought a lot about time and duration. And Bergson himself wrote about Einstein's discovery as something that was going to change the nature of philosophy. So we already know that human thought and our conceptualization of fundamental questions having to do with space and time have themselves been transformed by new discoveries in science. And of course, you know, we think of E equals mc squared as a principle of science that led to, among other things, nuclear weapons. But mm-hmm. it also led to a rethinking of the world, again, around, you know, if time is relative, then, well, what does that mean about, you know, other things that we used to think were fixed? What does it mean about the kinds of fundamental units of Newtonian physics? What does it mean about many of our assumptions about everything from gravity to waves that we can't see, but nevertheless are increasingly a part of our world in the 20th century? So all of that is to say that at one level, the kinds of developments in artificial intelligence are like the kinds of developments in, say, quantum mechanics, because they leaked well outside of the containers that were used to think about what science was doing and how science was used. But the parallels go on from that because, for example, we know that the recognition on the part of different state governments that quantum mechanics would have implications for the development of weapons was something that led to an increased investment in the research of physicists. And physicists had a very good run in the early 20th century. And they had that good run in large part because of the role of physics in warfare. You know, many European nations and the US too recognized that developments in science and technology were directly correlated with success on the battlefield. And it just so happened, of course, that that coincided with the time that Einstein was making his discoveries and others were building on Einsteinian notions of relativity. And you had, of course, Heisenberg, and you had Schrodinger, and you had Niels Bohr, and you had others who were taking the elements of quantum mechanics and quantum physics and developing really extraordinary ideas, not only about specific technologies that could grow out of that, but also about ways of viewing the world and the like. But there was also clearly from that beginning point, the recognition of the military uses and therefore the geostrategic, geopolitical advantages of advanced research in these areas. So without even suggesting that AI has the kind of potential to unleash the kind of power that nuclear weapons can unleash, and have that power, of course, to cause great devastation in the world directly from the explosion of a nuclear device, is not necessary in order to draw some parallels. Because the truth of the matter is we don't quite know what AI will lead to. Now, I have a colleague at Berkeley, Stuart Russell, who perhaps you've talked to and perhaps you've mm-hmm. talked to on this program, and I work very closely with him. I used to go to Davos with him to introduce him at panels mm-hmm. at the World Economic Forum. And of course, Stuart was convinced that that AI, precisely because of its role in the development of autonomous lethal weapons, could have the same kind of direct military power that the nuclear bomb had, in part because it could deploy nuclear weapons and do so without direction by, or at least not maintained direction by, and at some point in the development of AI, without even a resort to human intervention. And he's started by making a few videos about this. He's talked a lot about it, and he continues to be concerned about it in his Center for Human-Centered AI at UC Berkeley. But even though Stewart and various colleagues, Max Tegmark and others, are clearly concerned about existential risk attached to AI, I don't mean necessarily to go all the way to that point to say that there are parallels. But I think given the fact that you have very serious people like Stewart and Max and others who are suggesting that, you know, there's real danger involved here, at the very least, it's incumbent upon us to think about what the uses of AI could be in a military context and to be concerned about at least anticipating, if not outright controlling, some of the kinds of military uses. Because, of course, you know, the global control of any new technology is a kind of Pyrrhic victory. One other thing we learned from the film Oppenheimer was that Oppenheimer's great dream to share nuclear secrets with other great powers in the wake of World War II, intended by Oppenheimer to basically persuade everybody never to use this technology, is a very tenuous kind of ambition, and a tenuous ambition because, of course, geopolitical tensions will ultimately govern the development of these technologies and their potential use by nation states in competition with each other. Although, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there hasn't been a major use of nuclear weapons for anything other than testing purposes. And I suppose at some level, Oppenheimer so far has been right about his idea that the power of nuclear weapons would constrain their use. But anyway, the point I'm making is that you don't have to go that full distance to see the usefulness of this historical analogy, and then to think about both national and global mechanisms to think about, and this is the name of your podcast, of course, to think about how you regulate the potential misuse of AI for a global arms race and potential global conflict.
So, Professor, you made some very important points. If I may just follow up on two quick points. If you're saying that, let's say we're not going the full distance, but there is a little bit of a parallel with nuclear weapons or nuclear arms with AI, there is an international body that kind of regulates nuclear weapons, you know, the International Atomic Energy Commission. Do you think, and this is a conversation I've had with a lot of guests, including your colleague Stewart, et cetera, on this show, is there a need for an organization like that for AI?
Oh, I think so. I think it would be a great thing to have such an organization. And I would imagine that, you know, that people like Stewart would agree with that. Although I haven't talked to him specifically about it. But my sense is that, you know, nothing that is done nationally in this regard is going to be sufficient. It has to be a global solution. You know, I've spent, as an anthropologist and historian, a good deal of my life in South Asia and in India in particular. And the development of the atomic bomb in India was a big, big event. And the, you know, various kinds of accomplishments of the Indian state and in the domain both of you know, the moon landing that took place last mm-hmm. summer, but before that, the successful testing mm-hmm. of a nuclear weapon was a very big deal, because it's about signifying that you're a great world power. And you know, obviously, China, Russia, currently both at some levels, more in the case of Russia, but significantly in the case of China, in a very tense relationship with the United States, would mean that without inclusion of those nations and indeed the other nuclear powers, no national consensus is going to do what is necessary. So yes, I would very much think that an international body like the International Atomic Energy Commission would be a great thing. But to say that is, of course, just it will get you to square one. But then you have to figure out what kind of authority you might grant it, how you govern it. We know from the UN how difficult that is.
Yeah. I want to follow up a little bit on that, but I want to take your point about Oppenheimer, Nick, that he wanted to share the secrets with everybody. And I draw a little bit of an analogy to open sourcing of AI. There are two camps today, whether one should open source or one should not, because the people who want to open source talk about innovation and not having a monopoly and other things, and the people who want to keep it closed source talk about bad actors, etc. I want to find out, and we've had many different people give different opinions. I want to find out, where do you come out on this?
Sure. Well, just to begin to respond to your question, just 2 weeks ago at the New York Academy, I had a conversation with Jan LeCun. Mm-hmm. And Jan, of course, and again, I'm sure you've talked to him on this podcast, is very much in favor of open sourcing AI, and he actually encouraged Facebook and now Meta to do that, and they did. Mm-hmm. And he's committed to continuing that, and spoke about that in the fireside chat we had with him just 2 weeks ago. And what is interesting, of course, in the case of Jan is that he is a kind of techno-optimist, or he kind of almost is the is a prime example of a techno-optimist, because he doesn't agree with Stuart Russell or
Jeffrey Hinton
or Jeff Hinton
or Yoshua Bengio.
Yep. He doesn't think there's a downside. He thinks that humans have figured out how to work together for the most part. He thinks that technology will be used to pretty good ends. He's optimistic about both human nature and about the way technology gets absorbed and appropriated into human life. But I think if you pressed him and he said, okay, I'll just, suspend that particular judgment and talk just about the question of open sourcing in relationship to potential global threats or dangers, he would also say it's better to have, the so-called good guys, whoever they are. These are notional terms. I'm not using them mm-hmm. in the way in which our political leaders use them somewhat naively. Mm-hmm. But, it's better to have the good guys knowing what's out there so they can develop ways, as in, for example, the whole industry of cybersecurity, to fend against, the so-called bad guys. And that argument, of course, has been made by others in this field, even if they are more in the order of techno-pessimists than techno-optimists. But I think my view, and it is a reflection, too, of the kinds of priorities of the New York Academy of Sciences. I mean, we're a scientific organization, mm-hmm. which doesn't mean we only work on science, but it does mean that we're governed by certain kinds of principles that are in accord with what we consider to be the way science works best. And the way science works best is through open sourcing. You publish your research, mm-hmm. you open it up to the community of peers. You see what the reactions are out there in the mm-hmm. community of people who actually know what you're doing. You hope that they will, if not simply agree with what you do, they might test it themselves, seek to replicate it. And by doing so, fine-tune the finding or direct it in a different way, or use it as the basis for new knowledge and new discovery. So we're deeply committed to that principle in science, and we believe that's why science has become so powerful. And that is also why I'm very concerned about the notion, clearly certain things are classified, certain kinds of military applications are doubtless necessarily governed by certain kinds of protocols of secrecy. But science itself is best done openly, and that means openly, whoever's going to do it, wherever they're going to do it. In fact, at the Academy, we have a kind of global network of scientists in every part of the world, whether it's a place that is not in agreement with the U.S. in terms of basic political principles, or is, because we think that science is a global community and mm-hmm. is in in the main and for the most part, a force for good, even with its potential to be misused in some of the ways we've been talking about already.
Nick, just one other point I want to follow up. You talked about India, your experience and how the pride is. And there is a two aspect. There is a little bit of a AI nationalism that is going on where, countries, just following up on the nuclear thing, there's a nuclear club. And I think countries have figured out we don't want to be left behind on this AI club because the U.S. owns the chips and other stuff and they could hold back. So there is this push that is happening. But I just had a conversation with a leader from India and with some people from Europe. The other thing, and I want your view on this, is they are worried about their culture and language getting washed out by AI with the American Silicon Valley push towards data, because AI is about data and the ingestion of American, English, and Western data coming in. And that's a big fear. I constantly listen to leaders in small countries in Europe, listen to people, leaders in Africa. I listen to leaders, as you mentioned, in India. Today itself, they were saying that we've caught centuries of history that could get wiped out by this. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I have thought about it a lot because in my academic life, I spent a great deal of time in fairly small villages in the south of India. I studied Tamil as the language I worked in. A lot of people speak Tamil. It's not it's not a tiny language by any means, but it's a language that is spoken for the most part in Tamil Nadu in South India. In parts of Sri Lanka and in a few parts of Malaysia and Singapore, and that's and then in Toronto and other places where diasporic Tamil people live. But I'm deeply committed to the histories and the languages of different parts of the world, and that's what I've actually spent more of my life working on than ever thinking about AI. But one of the remarkable things about AI, and this is something we've all seen just really since GPT, is the capacity to translate, to work in multiple languages, and to read multiple languages. I mean, for a long time, I kept hearing from friends at Google that Google Translate was going to perfect the art of translation. But it was a very, very primitive, relatively speaking, way of translating. And we could all use our phones to order food in Beijing when we went to a restaurant where somebody wasn't speaking English. But beyond that, it really wasn't very useful. Now you can immediately get translations in just about every language in the world from X to Y without the necessary intermediation of English. Because of the ways in which LLMs work with neural networks and so on. So now, does that mean that that the historical record is going to be equally represented in the training data that is being used for LLMs, particularly if those LLMs are being trained in Palo Alto or south of Market in San Francisco? And of course not. And there is certainly, I think, a concern that a good deal of the training data that is used for LLMs, and we've seen this already in terms of the concerns about bias and stereotyped representations and classifications of different phenotypes and different kinds of people and so on. Are there concerns here? Yes, there are major concerns. And of course, what happens is the training sets privilege, first of all, the digital archive, because that's what they train on. And the digital archives that are used are presentist for the most part, and overrepresented in terms of English, places where English is spoken and where English sources are part of the data set. So I do believe that, this is something to keep an eye on. But I think that's true actually at every level when you start thinking about the training data. I mean, one of the problems with AI really from the start has been misrecognition of people on the basis of skin color and other kinds of physical characteristics. And we all know the terrible, terrible, mistakes that that AI has made around questions of race and to some extent gender and ethnicity and other demographic facts of social differentiation. So I do believe that we have to, you know, seriously think about this. And I also believe this, but I believe it as a historian as well, that major projects to digitize multilingual archives and multimedia kinds of archives will be necessary both to preserve these archives. And I spent a lot of time working in places where the records were actually disintegrating even as I was reading them, even as they were by white ants subject to the stresses and strains of climate, of humidity, of less than ideal storage conditions and a great deal of heat. So, digitalizing our human heritage is important, but it will have the advantage of digitizing the kinds of things that one needs to really begin to think about a more inclusive way of representing other languages and cultures in our new technological wonderland.
Just switching subjects, Nick, you said AI would make humans less exceptional. I think you wrote that somewhere. Can you explain to our audience, who we have some audience people who might be thinking they're very exceptional, so can you explain to them why that you think they're not as exceptional as they think?
Well, first, let me clarify that when I said that, I said AI could have two different kinds of, effects. Mm-hmm. It could make us think that humans were more exceptional or less exceptional. So please let me just kind of clarify that, because I actually put both of those in the paragraph. But what I meant, of course, is that, we used to think about artificial intelligence in relationship to fairly standard issue notions of what intelligence is. And, we've always thought we understood intelligence. We thought we knew what IQ meant. We thought we could measure IQ. Turns out we weren't doing such a good job of measuring intelligence. We were measuring all kinds of things that were proxies for intelligence, but they weren't actually necessarily intelligence per se. So all of which is to say that, that the idea of intelligence has been changing, but I think it's been changing a lot also in relationship to AI. And when McCarthy and others at Dartmouth in that conference that took place in the summer of 1956 coined the term artificial intelligence, it was a kind of great buzzword. But, AI wasn't very intelligent at that point. But it is now. And it is now in the sense that it can pass, can pass medical board exams, it can pass bar exams, it can go masters and chess masters, and, it can do extraordinary things that make humans feel like, oh my God, the machines are really taking over. At the same time they do that, they have encouraged us to begin to think a little bit differently about, not everything from the Turing test to how we actually think about machines. Turing test used to be simply, can a machine pass itself off as being human? Well, of course, it depends in what context. And, the Turing test is vastly inadequate, actually, to, cover the range of things that you would need to test for in order to really tell if you're talking to a human or a machine. And actually, it would have far less to do now with intelligence than it would with empathy or EQ, emotional, recognition of emotional qualities, etc. Mm-hmm. But we now, of course, as consumers of all this buzz and talk around and about AI, beginning to think, well, really the question is not, is a machine more intelligent than a human, but does it have sentience? Does it understand the world? Jan LeCun, for example, says that AI has no capacity to understand the world. It simply is a prediction model, and on the basis of massive amounts of computing power, massive amounts of data, it computes the next token, which happens to mm-hmm. be at least a word or part of a word, right? And and that doesn't actually require, nor does it imply, genuine intelligence or understanding. And, you know, so that too is part of the, you know, part of the definitional question when you're asking about whether humans are in fact less exceptional or more. I think the truth is that it's going to, AI that is going to change the way we think about what it is to be human. And we're going to think a little bit less about intelligence, a little more about something we call sentience or consciousness or self-understanding. It's already, of course, enabled, you know, whole new classrooms in philosophy to reinvoke Descartes and, you know, the history of philosophical thought about, you know, the self. And make that interesting to new generations of students who probably, you know, would find Descartes pretty dull and dry and boring if it weren't for the fact that it might help you think about AI. But it certainly is going to change the way we think about the human. And in so doing, as it recalibrates what machines can do and what humans can do, it could have these multiple effects. It could make us feel like the machines really are better judges of everything from, say, you know, just judges of judges. I mean, judges in the sense of the judge who's deciding on a sentence, because AI can be used for sentencing, or it can be used for the amount of bail that needs to be posted, or it could be used for determining whether or not you're going to get a loan for a house or an apartment. And it is used for all of these things. And some people, when increasingly it's used for medical, you know, for medical diagnosis, and certainly for reading things like x-rays and the like, and scans. And so, you know, at some point we're going to say, well, we are less exceptional because the machine can do some things better than us. But most people want to have a human who's part of that chain. And I'm sure we'll go on and talk about this. And most people will also say, just because it does all of these things doesn't mean it can ever really fully understand what it is to be somebody waiting for a judgment on the basis of whatever it might be we did, somebody waiting for a diagnosis on the basis of something that's going on in our bodies, or any number of other human you know, predicaments that are now being increasingly entered into this new power of artificial intelligence.
You also mentioned the soul in your piece in there, which I found very interesting. That, but you said, what? How do we define the soul as? So I don't know. It's. I thought that was fascinating. What was that point, Nick?
Well, you know, if you're thinking about consciousness and you're thinking about self-understanding, at some point, you get to, and pretty much continuously across human history, some discussion of a soul, something that is. That is, you know, if not immortal, certainly something that is in some ways, and it might be, you know, created by neurons, but it's in some ways extra physical, and it has a way of becoming identified with the me, with who I am, even more than my finger. I could, God forbid, lose a finger, and I would still be me. You lose your soul, then who are you? And of course, you know, that gets fed into the history of religious thought and philosophical thought. And, you know, some people take it now into, you know, panpsychism and think that there are souls or at least some manner of consciousness that is distributed across all of not only the animal kingdom, but even the material world. And then, of course, you know, I go back to some of the texts I used to read in college about Indian philosophical systems. And I think, well, you know, maybe the old sages had it right, because, you know, there were notions of the soul or Atman, which were distributed across every entity in the world or the universe, for that matter.
Yeah. Well, maybe we move from the soul to talk about the benefits of AI. Nick, how do we make sure the benefits of AI are distributed equitably and, you know, do not exacerbate the current social and economic inequalities that we have?
Well, this is a really hard question because, of course, our our levels of inequality have been increasing over the last few decades, mm-hmm. and the last decade in particular seemed to have gotten really out of control in many respects. And when you're talking about that level of inequality, you know, it's very likely that new discoveries in the domain of technology are simply going to exacerbate the inequality, and of course increase the wealth of the inventors, because the inventors are going to be creating technologies that can be turned into very profitable enterprises. And now we know, of course, that you look around at the major, you know, major corporations, major concentrations of wealth, and they're associated in large part now with not the old manufacturing firms of old, but the new technology companies of our day. So hard to know how AI can actually countervene that, or be used to control for that. I think open sourcing AI is an important part of it, mm-hmm. because I think some of the claims that have been made by, you know, very well-intentioned people, but nevertheless people who stand to benefit from concentrating the knowledge in AI, to the effect that, you know, these are dangerous kinds of forms of knowledge, and besides, you can only regulate it if you understand it, and mm-hmm. you can only understand it if you're developing it at this level, a little bit disingenuous, because mm-hmm. You know, I think we've seen how important it is to have, you know, much more inclusive participation in any kind of regulatory process, or any kind of process of discovery and use with respect to something as powerful as these kinds of technologies. But I also think that it's, if you think about AI as a distributed resource, you can potentially think about the fact that, you know, people are going to develop ways of using AI that will be very different, and will, if not decrease inequality, at least perforce become drivers of a slightly different logic of the concentration of wealth. You know, I've been interested in some of the studies that have been done recently around innovation. And it turns out, interestingly enough, that, and if you're talking even about technological innovation, it applies. Turns out that some of the new kinds of developments that have come out both of research labs, but also out of startups, that come up in places like China or India, turn out to be of greater utility to people in the developing world than the equivalent innovations that are coming out of the U.S. and North America and Europe, because they're people view what AI can do or what technology can do from the point of view of their lived life, their lived experience, and their lived experience is different. And and so instead of apps that just, you know, sort of make it more convenient to have multiple deliveries of food, and if you're living in Palo Alto, which is fine, you know, I mean, that's great. And believe me, San Francisco used to be a place where it was impossible to hail a cab, and now it's impossible not to have an Uber or a Lyft.
Yeah,
come very quickly when you summon it on your phone. You know, and as recently as when I moved to Berkeley in 2013. When I just couldn't get a cab. I called on the phone. I tried to flag it down from the I came from New York. I thought I could flag it on the street. Nobody would stop. you know. So I mean, I'm not against those innovations, but it does turn out that that an innovation economy that is predicated on different kinds of views, different kinds of subject positions, different places that one is from, makes a big difference in terms of distributing the benefits as well.
Yeah. Nick, you mentioned the term effective accelerationism. And it's, what are your thoughts on that concept and its potential implications for the rapid development of AI?
So let me begin by saying something about how AI is going to change our world for the better. Because I think you know, I've been focusing in part because of the questions on some of the potential negatives or dangers or concerns. Mm-hmm. Looking at AI from the point of view, for example, of science, it really is remarkable what AI is doing already. And clearly it's going to be continuing to do that in exponential ways. We have lots of conferences here at the Academy, and I was talking just the other night to a computational biologist who is developing new ways to both do drug trials very, very quickly. They're simulated, but they're really quite well done. To devise new ways of thinking about addressing cancers, including cancers like pancreatic cancer and bladder cancer that are very, very deadly. New ways of thinking ultimately about even the 3D printing of new organs and the like that are ravaged by disease are things that are being advanced by AI in just extraordinary ways. So even looking at the biomedical world that is very specific to our understanding of our own well-being as human beings, it's clear to me that AI has enormous potential, particularly when linked with the insights and discoveries of synthetic and structural biology, as well as CRISPR-Cas9 and gene editing and things of that nature. And I say that because, it's not science alone, or it's not the biomedical space alone that is seeing this. I mean, even, astrophysicists are understanding the cosmos in much more textured ways because of how AI is analyzing and working through the data that's coming from the Webb telescope, for example. There's just a host of things that AI is doing. Now, we talked briefly about education, but I also believe that AI has the potential to provide a kind of tutor for every student. And in schools where, class sizes and, in elementary and middle and high school are, 35, 40, to have a personalized tutor will be invaluable for students. Now, maybe it wouldn't be quite as good as having a human tutor, but it would. AI increases the value, the utility, the effectiveness of support that you can get as a student in ways that could be wonderfully democratizing in terms of educational achievement. So all of these are I think, really important to remember when thinking about, what the issues are about the rapid development of some parts of AI that are perhaps less immediately beneficial. So, effective accelerationism. I mean, recently Marc Andreessen came out with his, manifesto about this, and he makes Jan LeCun look like a skeptic. For Mark, everything in the world of tech is fabulous, and it's wonderful to to see his enthusiasm. And he holds many of the skeptics, not Jan, but many of the real skeptics, he holds them in, if not contempt. I mean, he certainly just said, why are you going on about this? I mean, technology has just been a net positive, and you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to worry about it, for example, in relationship to job displacement. But let me just say a word about job displacement, because, I've been reading recently Daniel Susskind's book, World Without Work. I've looked at the IMF report that suggested that up to 40% of the jobs that exist now won't exist in a certain number of years because of AI. I've been looking at other reports and studies and analyses of what the economic effects will be of AI across the board. And I think there's a general consensus that it's going to have major impact on the kinds of jobs that most people today have. And in particular, jobs that are at every level of the socioeconomic spectrum, so that it's not just about having robotic assembly lines in a automobile factory, but it's also about having every legal document basically drawn up by GPT, having having robots as waiters in every restaurant, and having, of course, ultimately this has been the something that hasn't quite happened yet, but driverless trucks, lorries, cars, taxis, and so on. Even if you kind of discount for irrational exuberance, if I can use that term, around, self-driving vehicles, which clearly have been predicted now every year for the last 20, you still get to major economic impact. Now, the division among, you know, the observers in this space is between those who accept that there'll be this level of job displacement or substitution, but then there will be new jobs that will come along, and they'll come along in time to, you know, to provide employment for everybody who loses a job. But the other side of that debate, as you know, and I'm sure you've talked to people on your podcast, is that it can't possibly do that. It can't possibly do it for two reasons, at least. One is because AI is so pervasive that it's just not precedented. Yes, sure, you know, agricultural revolution, industrial revolution, the first digital revolution, however you decide industrial revolutions are classified. Yeah, I mean, you know, other revolutions have led to job creation in new kinds of areas, new fields, and we have a lot of examples of that even in the last 20 years, in terms of coders and all sorts of others. But people say, some people say, some very smart people say, AI is different. And others say, even if AI isn't different, the timescale that we're talking about is simply so compressed that it will be impossible to create those new kinds of jobs in time to accommodate the numbers of people who will be displaced from their current kinds of careers and jobs and work. And that will create huge disruption potentially in our economy, but also in our social, cultural, economic, and political worlds, mm-hmm. because everything, of course, is connected. We know that in our world today, and this is true across many different kinds of cultural contexts, many people get their sense of identity from their jobs. Okay. And, you know, everybody wants to, in France, apparently retire at age 62. But you know, there's a kind of world of expectation that leads up to what you're going to do when you retire. And, you know, it's mm-hmm. at the end of having worked and so on and so forth. But it's much more common, in fact, to see correlations. This is certainly true in the U.S. between, you know, age of retirement and age of death, because people often will lose their sense of self-importance mm-hmm. when they lose their career. So there's that. But then there's just plain the economic question of how you support a population that may have 20, 30, even 40% unemployment. That's unimaginable. That takes you into mm-hmm. a depression. How do we anticipate or cope? Anyway, the point is that when you just put accelerationism next to technology and think about, you know, just the absolute inevitable, unconstrained good that will come from technological innovation, and you don't think about some of the potential downsides, you're setting yourself up at the very least for likely surprises that will be unpleasant, and at most for huge disruption. And I think in as much as we know we can't predict the future, we can nevertheless imagine different futures that we begin to think about and even prepare for.
Nick, you kind of touched on something I was going to ask you, which is something I ask, and we've had the head of the you know, Teachers Association, we've had educational job experts, etc. Do you believe major disruption in job in our economy is going to happen, or world economy? Forget about our economy. Do you think that's definitely a it's going to happen?
Well, again, I'm not an expert in this, but I've been persuaded by some of the things I've been reading that there will be major economic effects, and those effects in the first instance will be about the loss of certain kinds of jobs. And so the real question for me is the speed with which this will happen. Now, you know, there's certainly are, you know, constraints on picking up on technology, say in enterprises that know that they need to be slow, deliberate, careful in the way in which they introduce AI. And they know they need to be that because the people who are introducing AI are the people who will, of course, begin very quickly to recognize they might be designing the means of their own obsolescence and begin to resist this. And you know, every organization, whether it's a for-profit corporation or a university that I've run and experienced at every level, you know, is made up of people who vote with their feet, and their feet sometimes are you know, walking, and sometimes they're kicking, but they're, you know, nevertheless expressing different points of view. So I think, you know, I think there are ways in which some of the kind of issues of not accelerationism in the effective accelerationist sense, but acceleration in terms of technological adoption sense, might be you know, less dramatic than some people are predicting at this point. But I also think that it is very likely that in about 10 years, if, you know, GPT continues to advance at the pace that it has, LLMs and chatbots and so on get not only generalized in their use across business software, across you know, healthcare, across education, but also, you know, given you know, more and more of a place in relationship to the development of robotics, the creation of you know, companions, caregivers, coaches, therapists, personal assistants, tutors, whole range of things. You're gonna see that, you know, there'll be trainers for these things. There'll be mechanics for these robots, etc. But there'll be many fewer of those than there will be people who are displaced from work. And increasingly, it'll be not just about our production economy, our manufacturing economy, but about our service economy. Uh-huh. As well as about service that takes place not at, you know, fast food restaurants, but at, you know, law firms and yeah. and businesses and any number of other places where, you know, there have been lots of employment opportunities in the past and doubtful opportunities to reinvent themselves as businesses, enterprises, or whatever, with the same employment needs and demands.
Well, I think that subject itself is a whole new podcast, Nick, because I have so many questions, because that's an area of big concern. And I think, I don't think enough attention is being paid to it, but I do know that you have, unfortunately, to run. But Nick, final comments for our audience. I've told you the kind of audience it is. This is your time to address them.
Sure. Well, I think it's been, you know, implicit in everything we've been talking about, but I myself am convinced that, you know, this is a really, really important moment in our human history. It's one in which, you know, historical trends and precedents are being, you know, are being in some ways shown as true, but just, you know, exacerbated and accelerated in ways that are going to have, or have already had, but are going to have in very short order, dramatic effects across everything from, you know, our cultural lives, our social lives, creation and creativity in the arts. And we already know that, you know, the SAG-AFTRA strike in Hollywood was in part about AI, even though it was, you know, not yet the threat that people worry it's going to become, but they were anticipating it, and they were the first to really call out in a very public way some of the kinds of things I've been talking about here. But at every level, I mean, we talk about deep fakes, we talk about misinformation, we talk about disinformation, we know the role that social media has played in that respect. AI will be much more effective and much more pervasive. So it seems to me that only by beginning really to study and study with this kind of anticipatory lens, what the multiple range of effects are going to be on our understandings of ourselves as human beings, our understandings of ourselves as thinking, conscious, sentient, soulful, humans, our understanding of ourselves as social actors who increasingly have communities or find our partners in life or whatever it might be through the intermediation of digital technology, patients in hospitals, students in schools, and ultimately workers in an economy. We're all going to find our world changing and changing very, very quickly, and changing in ways that will really become potentially destabilizing, both for individuals and for society. And my sense is that we therefore have to broaden the conversations we're having, ensure that more and more people participate in them, find ways to really engage the public, and even more narrowly, to engage academics like me, that is to say, with my kind of background in the human and social sciences, to be part of these conversations so that we can have a better sense of how to think about the future and how to think about both the extraordinary opportunities and achievements that we can look forward to, but also how to really begin to, you know, carefully provide a framework within which the kinds of regulatory concerns that you're specifically concerned with might take place. And I feel that my explorations in this domain are just meant to invite a lot of different people who aren't necessarily thinking about these things into the conversation. And it's been a delight to talk with you, Sanjay. It's been really wonderful to be here. I'm sorry we can't go on for another 45 minutes. I'd love to do that.
Well, as you said to our audience, urgency, conversation, opportunity, some amazingly thought-provoking ideas and conversation, exploring the multifaceted dimensions of AI regulation with Nicholas Dirks. You provided some very, very valuable insights into the complexities of this ever-evolving field. So thank you, Nick, for taking the time. Thank you for being with us. It's really been a pleasure. And to our audience, be sure to subscribe to Regulating AI for more discussions on the intersection of technology, ethics, and policy. And please make sure to look up Nicholas Dirks and go to the National Academy of Sciences, where he's the president. Thank you, Nick. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Sanjay.
Thank you.